Okay, so yeah, I'm on my own today because mommy and baby are having a mommy baby spa day.
Okay.
Because it's Japan, you can do that. More succinctly, they've gone to like a regional community center where you pay $25 and from 10 a.m. until 7 p.m. they'll basically take baby off your hands except for feeding times, and they'll make you lunch and dinner.
Okay.
That's pretty, yeah, right? So you just basically tell them what days you want to go, and like I think you like reserve up to 3 days at a time, and you go in and they treat you. And if you, that's the short version. You can also do the long version where I think it's like a, it's at least a one night stay, which I find just boggles the mind. It's just like, so wait, what are you trying to tell me? You guys don't want to be here anymore, do you? But anyway, it's actually hopefully good for everybody. So the idea that, you know, you're not constantly got baby on your hands, but you can still, you know, take care of her. It probably is more angled towards, you know, the typical Japanese, you know, housewife situation where dad's at work and mom's just like, screw this crap. And, you know, you do need to like regain some sanity. So she said, you know what? I want to try it out. I got a friend who's going to go do it. And I was like, knock yourselves out. So I'll be here. So long story short, we have a little bit more time today to kind of like, you know, get into it and not feel any kind of background pressure. Not talking smack about my wife, but, you know, one of the challenges of working at home is, you know, sometimes mommy comes in and says, okay, seriously, I've got to like do something and I can't put this baby down. So here we are.
ご案内申し上げます。ただいま時空の調整中。3、2、1、発進。
You're listening to News from Tomorrow.
Let's get into it. Welcome to News from Tomorrow. My name's Kaelian Babcock, joined by Gary Spillman. Hey, Gary.
Heyo.
And Gary was nice enough to write up the agenda. I was a little bit out of it last week from Tuesday through Friday because of Typhoon Jebi. There was a lot of Jedi jokes.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. On the internets because of that.
Were you really feeling the force of Jebi, huh?
Oh my goodness. Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but that, luckily that's over with. But it did kind of put a crimp in things as far as like getting stuff done. But here we are again.
And here we are.
Yep. Nothing to see here, as it were.
Well, I'm glad that I followed sort of the progress of the storm amongst you and other friends on Instagram and whatnot, and just glad it just looks like everyone was okay, just like without power and for a bit and without water for a bit, but could have been a whole lot worse. Did see like a couple of places that were posted online, some old stomping grounds in Nipponbashi that just got completely wrecked. Just like, you know, store facades got just like crumpled and whatnot. And it's not like monumental damage, but it's like monumental, like, oh, the whole building got leveled, but it's like, it's the whole street got kind of trashed and whatnot. It's like, oh.
Yeah, it's the trees took a big whipping. I mean, okay. First of all, yes. Was there, bad property damage? There was some, it was pretty bad. A lot of rooftops got damaged. There's a lot of disaster porn on YouTube if you're interested. I try not to share that kind of stuff because it's, you know, it's a little, well, like I said, the word porn, as in it's a little bit kind of, maybe it's gratifying if you want to watch that, but yeah, it's real stuff happening to real people, and you know, while it's newsworthy, I don't know, it sucks to see that happen. Like, there's one I saw of a pizza delivery driver who was forced to work that day and is literally getting blown down the street. It's just on a moped. It's just really like, oh my goodness, trucks blowing over, stuff like that.
I saw the exact same one. In fact, actually, I kind of followed through, and from what I could read, it looks like Domino's kind of got lit up from a social media standpoint for, and like, why was this guy having to deliver pizzas in the middle of a tropical typhoon? Like, why was this guy even supposed to be on the road?
Apparently, all the pizza delivery drivers are still working, and I don't know if it was a satirical joke. There's a guy on Facebook I know, and he's not... I don't see him posting a lot of, like, tongue-in-cheek humor, but he actually posted, like, I've ordered pizza from three different places to see who can compete to actually bring me a pizza for lunch right now. And I was just like, whoa, dude, you know, too soon.
That's, ooh.
I mean, that was literally the day of. I mean, not even too soon. It was just like, dude, seriously? You're having people, like, do, like, what do I want to say, Hunger Games kind of crap for 20 lousy bucks?
That's
a little messed up.
That's pretty cruel.
Yeah, and, well, that's the kind of people who were stupid enough. I don't know if this guy, like I said, I don't know if it was true or not. I really hope it was just a tasteless joke. But those are the kind of people that were causing Domino's delivery drivers to get blown down the street. So I don't know what to say, man. You know, that's just, wow, not cool.
We live in a society.
It is a society, yes. But anyway, we experienced... it's interesting when the wheels of civilization come to a grinding halt, because we live in what I like to call an arcology, because speaking of science fiction, because our apartment, it's three buildings together that are basically sealed off behind, you know, like electronic gates and stuff like that. And we've got, like, you know, our own, obviously, you know, water and electricity, even our own internet is all self-contained. But there turns out there was a single point of failure. Haha. Strangely, not for the inside the apartments. So that power was apparently restored really quickly, although we'd already bailed at that point because, you know, we have a mother-in-law. people got their house power back quickly, but the elevators were out, the internet was out, the cable TV was out, and the water was out. And whereas not being able to charge your cell phone is mildly inconvenient, not being able to, like, drink, bathe, or use the bathroom is a little bit more serious.
Yeah.
I asked one of our neighbors, and I should have realized, you know, luckily we live in Japan, so as far as baths are concerned, it's like, no problem, just go down to the local sento, you know, bathhouse, and you're covered. In terms of the bathroom situation, people were having to, like, go to local supermarkets and stuff like that, and just, you know, ugh. And plus, we live on the ninth floor, so trudging up down nine floors. We did have access to a water spout. We have the actual apartment water tank right next to our building. But trudging up down the stairs, like I said, if we had not had the option to bail, you know. But as it was, it was still, you know, again, first world problems. We were only inconvenienced for a few days. But it does remind you, it could have been worse. There's houses around the neighborhood. You can see them, spot them from the windows, where it's like blue tarps with sandbags on top because all the tiles got shattered. Osaka Castle Park looks like some lumberjacks with a squirrel vendetta went nuts on the trees. You know.
Interesting choice of phrasing there. That's pretty funny. I mean, laughing at the situation. I'm just laughing at, like, just the mental picture that's been constructed there.
No. I'm here all week. But, you know, if you can't laugh, you cry kind of thing. But, no, seriously, I mean, the trees, there was a lot of branch damage, but there were actually a few trees uprooted, and you see that a lot, just trees completely blown over. One of the weird things you don't really think about is there were a lot of traffic lights that were knocked askew. There was actually one pole I saw near Fuse where it was the pole and the traffic light was just gone. So I'm assuming it literally just blew off the end. You know how they're like a long pole. With people at home who can't visualize this, there's like a long pole, and they bolt the traffic light onto this pole, and it hangs across the street. And there was the pole, just no traffic light. So it was like, wow, that's impressive. We basically, the wind speeds were 200 kilometers an hour. So I don't know. I don't remember what that would be in miles. But
200 kilometers an hour is that's 120 miles per hour.
That's three flags, you know, when it comes to gale force winds. Yeah. down in the old marina. That's as bad as it gets. So it was pretty gnarly. We actually had water. I should post this. We had water blowing. We have very new doors to our balcony, So the seals are really good. So it's essentially like, you know, hermetically sealed when we've got those windows closed. But the winds were so strong and we're facing south into the wind. It was blowing water through the seals into the apartment.
I saw the video online. Yeah, it's just, yeah.
That was pretty gnarly. Like, it was like bubbling, making these bubbling noises like a teapot.
Yeah, just like percolating into the seals.
Yeah, it was pretty funky. So, but again, we could have been worse. We're all fine. And it did kind of set me back a few days on stuff, but otherwise, yeah. Anyway, now you've guys got like, what, three? I know we're talking about weather like at the beginning of every episode recently, but it has been kind of on our minds. And now I see there's like three hurricanes at the same time coming up in the Atlantic. So good luck with that.
Yeah, we were actually just talking about that because we're going to be down in the, well, actually, we're going to be down in Houston this weekend. I guess fortunately for us, none of the hurricanes are set to hit that area we're going to be in, but I mean, we're going to get weather from it, obviously.
Right.
What's really kind of terrifying for a lot of people on the East Coast is that they're sort of mapping the big one, which I think it's hurricane, was it Frida or Francine or Francis or something? Yes.
Francis Ford Coppola. Yeah.
Francis Ford Coppola.
One of the Coppolas. But anyway, now, yeah. Sorry, bad joke again. But yeah, they said that there's like one heading for Puerto Rico again. So, wow, our thoughts are with you guys. Hope that doesn't go badly. One's heading for, I think, South Carolina. They already got mandatory evacuations. So
yeah, that one actually, that's the one I was talking about. And they were saying that the path and strength of that hurricane is looking eerily a lot like Hurricane Hugo, which hit that area back in 89. And I remember that hurricane. It kind of like pretty much.
God, that is way back. Yeah. See, that's one of the things. I mean, I'm not saying that my grasp on like history in terms of like remembering which hurricane was when is all that great. But being from Florida, you know, you live through a hurricane literally every year, maybe two. So you kind of lose track. But at the same time, you also get kind of, I don't want to say, I was on the West Coast. So it's fairly sheltered because it has to cross the whole peninsula before it hits you. But it does mean you get a little bit jaded. Maybe not jaded is the right word, but you know, you get kind of lackadaisical about it. And again, you grow up saying, yes, I grew up with hurricanes, but you do not grow up with the full fury and nastiness. So, you know, I'd have to say that I can literally say I led a sheltered life in that situation. But now seeing the way things are now is like you get a whole new appreciation for how bad it can really be. Anyway, that being said, we really should get into the show. But again, guys, sorry I kind of got derailed there, but it really is more like current events at home and the part where we were out of our house for 4 to 5 days. So, you know, again, kind of topical. But back in the world of sci-fi, I did want to say before we begin, one thing is Moonves is out. One, apparently that is his pronunciation of his name is Moonves, and two, he is out. And this is Les Moonves, the head of CBS, is being forced to step down by the machinery of the studio deciding to leverage the Me Too movement. And I would have to say that it's definitely kind of a bit of inside baseball political machinations that somebody wanted him out and they used that as a convenient excuse because, come on, there's no way they didn't know. But anyway, it's relevant to us because it's, again, not to trivialize what the people went through who were, you know, being harassed and attacked by Les Moonves, but it does mean that things in the showbiz world, which we do cover, are going to change. And it sucks that, socially speaking, it only happens when it benefits somebody's bottom line. But it does mean that even in the realm of News from Tomorrow, we're going to see changes coming from CBS that will affect the the entertainment that we like to watch. So I'm not going to dig myself any deeper with that. But yeah, there you are. Moonves is out. Okay. But in speaking about being a little bit more progressive and empowering, we've got news on the Captain Marvel front. Gary, you want to lead off with that?
Yeah, sure. Well, they Marvel, DC dropped a whole bunch of stuff over the weekend about Captain Marvel, which is currently, I think it's in post-production at this point now. Mm-hmm. But we get to see production photos. The first production photos of one of the most legendary of sort of collective Marvel nemesis out there, and that's the Skrulls. And
very old school. When I saw that, when I went to look at the comic art, I was like, oh my God, these guys. I mean, I remember seeing them as comic book villains before I even really knew what comic books were. It's how far back it goes for me.
Skrulls go super way back, but also they've kind of gone in and out of being like this sort of like I guess collective like boogeyman sort of like just force within Marvel Comics. I mean, within recent history, there was the whole Secret Skrull saga, which it very much kind of like, you know, suddenly you find out like all these people that you thought were humans, now it turns out they were Skrulls. Like, what? Who is a Skrull? Who isn't a Skrull? Oh my God.
Which apparently they're talking about this. Maybe they're really going to play on that in the movie as well. Yeah. That how many people within the current MCU, and then there's no actual teaser yet, just the photos and people speculating. But somebody showed a picture of Hawkeye, and they're like going, you know, kind of like then they superimpose a Skrull head, like dun dun dun. And I think maybe it's just tongue in cheek, but. It's interesting because it kind of plays on the conceit of what Hydra was doing, but with a whole extraterrestrial scope. And I got to say, looking back at the old artwork of the Skrulls originally, I mean, their times change and designs change, but it was a little bit laughable. You're like, really? These guys? I'm supposed to be scared?
Yeah. You know? Initially, it was like, so what's their superpower? Are they just going to crush you to death with the weight of their chin?
Oh, and actually, and it also looks like, you know, come on, guys, a little of Thanos fanboyism much? Come on, a little bit like, you know, we just want to like sculpt our scrotum chins to match this guy? I don't know.
That would be a pretty hot take if it's like the Skrulls are just basically like just an entire race of like Thanos stands, and they just can't, for some reason, like none of them can actually shapeshift into him. And so they're just like really butthurt the entire time.
That's what their whole premise of their invasion is.
So this is the entire extent of your entire people's angst, man. Y'all messed up.
It was our holy grail, the one we couldn't quite achieve.
One dude we couldn't turn into but they dropped a photo of Ben Mendelsohn, who Star Wars fans will remember as the guy who played Orson Krennic in Rogue One, as being like, I guess he's the chief Skrull in this movie, and in full costume. And I must say it looks good. The only problem I have with it is that it just reminds me too much about that really bad live action Dragon Ball Z movie they did like about 10 years ago. Like
it's very borderline. I mean, yeah, sorry to jump in there, but it's just like, I mean, it doesn't take a designer to call this one, but that pale green it's actually a little bit like a cheap Star Trek character from like Next Generation in say like 88, 89. Yeah. I know, but it's honestly, it's just the color palette they went with. They could have done an X-Men and updated it slightly. They could have kept the green, but given a little bit more natural variety and texture that would have still kept them Skrulls, but not looking like they jumped out of a 1970s comic book with a 1990s design aesthetic.
Yeah, I mean,
there's some Babylon 5 uniforms left over kind of thing, you know.
They're just a few pouches away from being like 92 era like Marvel or even Image Comics, like, you know, like suits they're wearing. The one pick that they've dropped of like the three Skrulls emerging from the surf.
That's a very, very interesting shot too.
Yeah, my favorite hot take of that is someone like posted that on Twitter and said like, you know, these guys are about to drop like the hottest R&B jam from like 1992, going way back.
Oh, wait. I know what they're called, too.
Do you have it?
Skrulls to Men.
Perfect.
That works on many levels. Yes, thank you. I now officially get to do the dad jokes. So, anyway, sorry. You're right. That actually is very much a got a boy band vibe. It's kind of funny. But I just, yeah, I mean, I'm sure they'll do a good job. I'm very open-minded about this. I think it's really interesting that they're going to apparently have the movie take place in the 90s and then, wait, 80s? 80s? 90s?
90s.
90s. And then through time travel, I guess, through the time stone, they're going to bring her forward into the Infinity War. Question will be is, are they going to send her back again, which would make future movies kind of hard? Or are they going to say, you know what, you're in the future, you're stuck here, which kind of sucks for her. But I guess who she is as Captain Marvel, which is a fairly complex character, she might shrug it off and be like, you know, whatevs, and just, you know, be happy in the future.
Could be. Yeah, but it does take place in the 90s. They got to actually, I just recently found this picture of Brie Larson, sort of like, I guess, pre-superpowered. Exposure, whatever turn the event that turns her basically into Captain Marvel, sort of in her civvy clothes, and she's like, yeah, she's like rocking in like a vintage Nine Inch Nails t-shirt. I'm like, oh man, the 90s. I remember the 90s. I guess we're old enough now that we can like whistle like, yeah, I remember when that thing first happened way back when, like, which is what, like, you know, like our parents or your uncle or my aunt or whoever, like, probably did back, like, you know, when the 60s sort of got a retread pop culturally. So here we are then. I was like, oh, that's cool. And then, of course, situated later in that that article, I think it was IO9 article, I had a pic of de-aged Nick Fury looking like a very, very silky smooth looking Sam Jackson.
Oh, nice. De-aged. Like, oh, they're doing the Ant-Man Hank Pym thing.
Yeah, it's Samuel Jackson's got both eyes in this one.
What? So,
yeah, getting his eye jabbed. Yeah, I'm guessing at some point, you know, Nick Fury gets his eye jabbed out by the Kree or the Skrulls or whatever. Mm. Maybe his eye is a Skrull. I don't know.
God, that's terrible. By the way, yeah. I'm just one more comment on the preview shot here of them walking out of the surf. It's like, are they the most incompetent, like, you know, undercover conquerors ever, because they landed their ship in the water? You know, what's going on here? Is this a tongue-in-cheek reference to Alien Nation? Again, 90s right there, boom. I mean, you know, what's going on here? I don't know. But anyway, moving on. Okay, so, but yeah, apparently, once again, kind of as a callback to what we were talking about in the last show, there have been issues with trying to get all the Marvel characters under one licensing roof. And they kind of did so by saying, well, we can have the Skrull, we just can't have certain Skrull characters. Like, naming them by name, they're not allowed to be in the movie because of the licensing. But if you have them as a race, yeah, that does an end run. It's kind of like how Stephen Colbert was able to keep his name on The Late Show because he actually is Stephen Colbert. No, sorry, that's actually completely inappropriate. I have to put a link to that. There's a funny thing here, and I'm totally failing it, but apparently Stephen Colbert was being told by Comedy Central he wasn't allowed to use his name anymore. But anyway, again, off track. Back on the track, I like your comment here, is that Piccolo from Dragon Ball Z? Sorry, as you mentioned before. Okay, Daredevil Season 3 trailer is dropping. What?
Yeah, it's out.
That's interesting because, yeah, I'll have to look at that. As we've talked about before, Daredevil season one was a fantastic. Season two got a little cartoony, and it ended in a very, how do I want to say, I don't know. It ended in a very well-paced climactic sense, but there wasn't that typical like hook to make you go, I really, really want to come back and watch this.
Yeah, I mean, by cartoony, I think we all mean like, hey, how are we going to end this thing? Gigantic rooftop battle full of ninjas.
Also, I mean, overall, and it's the very difficult tightrope they walk in bringing these age-old characters. I say age-old. You know, these characters have been around for a long time. And occasionally there's a retread necessary, not just because of a story growing stale or too much baggage, but also because cultural aesthetics change, where if you try to tell a story about a bunch of people running around in yellow and blue spandex, people are going to check out the minute, you know, the credits roll. You know, laugh at and say whatever, and next time I'll bring my kids. But so when you do the way they did, when they built into Daredevil in season one, was amazing, and it really was like you're doing the build. Also, the same way with Jonathan Nolan's Batman, where it's like it felt very natural how they built up and built up to when Batman became Batman. You're like, well, duh, that was the next logical step. But then when they say, okay, we need some stories, let's go ahead and bring out some fan favorites, then you run into the retread problem again of how can I bring this onto the screen without making it a total laughing stock? And so where it's just a little bit too fantastical, it works well in a comic book, but it doesn't translate well to the screen.
Yeah. Well, yeah, season two was kind of like it had its ups and downs. Honestly, like when they got back to pulling Wilson Fisk back on the screen, that's when it sort of started to come together in bits and pieces of it. And the one thing that kind of like I had a hard time sort of I was okay with the giant rooftop ninja battle in New York, in the middle of downtown New York, right, in Hell's Kitchen, whatever. The one thing I just couldn't get my like mind around, like from a suspension of disbelief kind of thing, was wait a minute. So you have a hole the size of like a skyscraper in downtown New York, and nobody's noticed. Like no developer's gone like, what is this hole doing here? Like, what is up with this? Do you realize how much that hole's worth at this point, with real estate prices being what they are in anywhere in the tri-state area or the five boroughs? So that always like kept bugging me. Well,
your property values. That's awesome.
So it was uneven in points. Do you know how much this worth, the street value of this hole is? Oh my God. The, I'm interested in seeing, I mean the trailer that's very generous. It's like, it's like a 15 second sort of like blip. But what they're setting up for is, one of the more interesting and iconic bits of Daredevil lore, and that's, it looks like, judging from the last time we saw Matt Murdock at the end of the Defenders, is that they're setting things up for playing into the Born Again storyline.
Okay, for those of us at home who don't know what that is,
basically it boils down to the Kingpin finally figures out who Daredevil is. It's Matt Murdock. And then proceeds to go about using all of his power to make basically Matt Murdock's life an absolute, total, complete, utter nightmare. The idea that, like, well, you know what? I could just kill the guy. You know, he has caused me so much pain. You know what? Like, killing him is just not going to be enough. I'm just going to make everything in his life just, like, you know, just grind it all to dust and just leave him broken. And it actually ends with one of my favorite lines of dialogue in any comic I've ever read. Not to totally ruin everything for it, if they do go this route, they're going to have to either cut a whole bunch out, or they're going to really have a long series three, which I don't know, they might. It seemed like series two was very long. But the sort of Kingpin thinks he's won, and then, you know, he thinks he's completely crushed Matt Murdock. You know, everything that Matt has ever wanted, like ever loved or cared about in his life, is now just torched. Some of it literally. And then he gets this sort of like letter in the mail, more or less, that says, "Show me a man who has nothing left to live." I might be getting the quote wrong, but "Show me a man who has nothing left to live for, and I'll show you a man without fear." Which, of course, is the byline for Daredevil, Man Without Fear. And the Kingpin thinks he's finally taken care of Daredevil, and then has this bleak realization that doing all this to him may have simply just given Matt Murdock, like, you know what, I got nothing else to live for, so I got no intention to hold back. And then the grim realization at the end of that story arc, they realize, like, I think I may have just actually created my worst nightmare by creating Matt Murdock's worst nightmare. And then that leads into the next big epic, like sort of story within the Daredevil series, and that's the fall of the Kingpin, which, gee, guess what that's about.
Right. I bet it's about Kingpin falling.
Yeah, falling down some stairs. Either.
Yeah, ooh. But I gotta say, that's really interesting. I like that conceit where you get to see him suffer, and then there's that realization where the Kingpin, as clever as he is, and I can see in the portrayal of the Kingpin in the series so far, that would be really in keeping with his way of going about things. So I'm really pleased if they were to go that way. It seems believable for the character. But the thing is that, yeah, he's so used to outsmarting people and playing people, and then to get hoisted by his own petard and his own hubris, and to realize that, oh no, you really would have been better off just killing the guy. So, and if you didn't, I mean, he was hoping to break him, right? But if he ended up failing, then he's screwed. He had a gamble, and if he fails that gamble, then yeah, that would work really well if they went ahead and go that route and don't get too lost in the weeds in whatever fallout is, you know, come after Daredevil's own season two. Then I think that would go really well into a season four as well, then, because you could sit there and just do one storyline in season three and then the next one in season four.
It definitely sets things up for like one to go right into the other, like not even need for like 6 months later. It's more like, yeah, like we're just picking right up where this left off, like moments ago, just to refresh you for this season. But yeah, that and also it looks like, judging by the teaser or whatever, it looks like Matt's going to go back to basics and going back to the old school, like just black pajamas and a headband kind of costume thing going on rather than running around. Well, partly because I'm guessing if it plays out a lot like Born Again, like he literally loses everything from like his apartment, all his physical possessions, like pretty much like Daredevil is like homeless, living in the streets. Yeah, everything. And so he just has to go back to like what do we have left? Well, I found some black sweatpants and a shirt, and I, you know, and okay, that's it. Okay, well, I don't even have a weapon. I just I'm blind. I can beat people up really good, and I didn't have anything
to cover my head with. So, by the way, I'm not wearing any pants.
Yeah.
Sorry. All of a sudden I had this image of him saying, well, crap, I guess this will be my bandana. Oh, awkward. Well, yeah. That's okay. I can't say anything.
You're in the pants.
Anyway. Well, you paint a really, appealing picture, and I'm looking forward to seeing where they go with this. Daredevil, of course, was Daredevil my first entry, or was it what's her name?
Jessica Jones.
I think Daredevil might have. Was it which one came first? It was Daredevil, wasn't it?
Daredevil was the very first of all the Marvel Netflix series.
Yeah, and that was the one where you're just sitting there like going, "Oh, holy crap! I am so into this." I mean, it really just set the bar.
Yeah. And well, to be honest, if they're going to be doing season three and they're bringing back Vincent D'Onofrio as Wilson Fisk, then well, you already have me on board then.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll watch that for sure.
All right. Well, all right. Very exciting stuff. Here's again, hoping and looking forward to a good season. So did you end up watching Killjoys?
I watched the first episode of Killjoys, actually. Yes.
And thoughts?
Well, this is very much like watching it. The one thing I really liked about it is they sort of like just kind of throw you into the world they've constructed, and they don't really bother to really have to sit down and like hold your hand and explain things like typical network television would in this case, where like, you know, there's a lot of exposition to explain this and that. It's just more of along the lines of it's just woven into the dialogue, and the narrative is plotting, it's running forward with this, and you just, not at a breakneck pace where you're struggling to keep up, but it's doing so with no apologies to like, we're not going to stop and say, oh, and by the way, this thing we call the rack, it's actually blah, 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 blah. It just like, they just kind of go with it.
Again, one of the hallmarks of good science fiction is where the people, the characters in the story completely buy into it to the point where you're like, okay, I guess this is what we're doing right now.
Yeah, they don't spend a lot of time on world building, like a lot of Minutemen world building. It just, here's the world, and you can kind of piece together things.
And to be fair, if you keep watching it, they do, as any good storyteller should, go back and revisit some, they flesh things out. So, you know, not to worry, right? But anyway, continue. I'm curious to see what else you thought about it.
Well, my first take on it, and granted, I just watched the first episode, was, wow, this is sort of like the kinder, gentler, less incredibly violent version of like Altered Carbon in terms of the way that their sort of world is structured. You know, you have these bounty hunters running around sort of as like, we're kind of impartial third parties employed to sort of keep the peace for this big Weyland-Yutani like company that kind of runs this entire little solar system that everything's taking place in. And
there was a bit of a Firefly vibe to it as well in that respect.
Yeah, they really play up the Wild Wild West sort of aspect of it.
Yeah, and everybody has particular, they have their own jargon and slang, which is always a little tricky, as you and I well know. You don't want to feel too precious about it. It's a very delicate line to cross, but I think it's important in terms of that kind of world building where taking the challenge to play with that by saying, well, obviously they're going to have their own language and their own customs language will have change over time and so on and so forth, and walking that fine line where it actually becomes fun and just part of the fabric of that world without feeling like a little bit like roll your eyes and going, yeah, whatever. I mean, let's be fair. I mean, there's a lot of sci-fi we watch where they do that. And I mean, one of the most famous would probably be Star Wars, where they're saying, well, we got this thing called the Force, and we got this thing called the Jedi, and you know, it's like duct tape because it's got a dark side and a light side, and it binds the universe together. And you're like, okay, cool, I can see that. So anyway, one of the things interesting, I've watched this previously up through season 3, and I'm rewatching it now with Machiko, and she digs it, and she actually has complimented its world building, and she's watched Firefly with me. She's watched Dark Matter, which kind of was a little bit sloppier in terms of not really being sure what story it wanted to tell. It was fun, but it's a little more bubblegum. And I think that Killjoys hits a nice balance. And I guess sci-fi may have felt the same way too, because they're going to give Killjoys like its season 4 and 5 to wrap up while they were out slaughtering all the other shows and deciding, you know, who lives and who dies. They did give Killjoys, instead of outright canceling them, gave them the chance to gracefully wrap it up, which I appreciate. But she and I are still on season 1 together. One of the things that's really entertaining is, of course, if people haven't watched this, the show creator is a woman, and it shows in some of the fan service, which is definitely got a feminine hand in it, you might say. So they show one of the main characters is, of course, Dutch, which is a female RAC agent called a Killjoy, which is where the season or series gets its name from. And she gets really like bummed out at one point. There's kind of a falling out amongst the team. And so she goes and lets off some steam by hiring a local prostitute to take her frustrations out on. So it's just like, oh, hello. Because, you know, when guys write things like that, you don't tend to see the girls having quite that much fun. And it's not like tawdry or anything like that. It's just kind of off the cuff, matter of fact, like, yep, this happened, you know, shot in a safer television friendly way. But you're like going, oh. So also the fact that she has a her heterosexual life partner, the younger brother, drawing a blank here. We've got Davin, we've got Dutch, and we have Johnny. Yes, yeah, so her heterosexual life partner, Johnny, who's a relatively attractive man, but of course, even though they will like spoon in bed together, they'll never have sex, and she can confide all of her, you know, secrets to, and it's just like, really? Really? But overall, it's a fun show. I like the overarching story, which I really recommend getting further into it. It's interesting. Again, it's in terms of world building, they have like this a religion of monks called the Skarbaks. And at the beginning, you're like going, okay, that's a thing. And then you find out that the mythos behind the Skarbaks and even some of the jargon people will use, like thank the trees, comes back later in season three. And you're like, oh my God, this all ties together. And so really well done. So I, like I said, I highly recommend it.
That was actually probably one of the more interesting sort of like visual bits that they had in the first episode that I watched. It was like, oh, okay, this is interesting. They got this sort of like somewhere between like a Buddhist monk meets like the flagellants, like sect of Christianity, all kind of like merged together into something interesting there. But the but overall, if you dig Cowboy Bebop, it's very much in that vibe. There's a lot of elements that are very similar in that, like, hey, it's basically Space Bounty Hunters. So go check it out.
Absolutely. Yeah, and and in terms of like Firefly, it's got that kind of family, you know, team becomes a family kind of vibe that leads to loyal following of cosplayers at Comic-Con kind of thing. So with its appropriate number of quotable lines that, you know, will really rile people up and get them going. So yeah, that's I agree, definitely one of the more solid and well told serial spaceship cop / western shows to come out in a while. Okay, next we got coming up, and I guess I should have kind of like led with this one after Daredevil 3 is The Punisher. Going back briefly to the Netflix Marvel Universe. Is that an appropriate phrase, Netflix Marvel Universe?
It is now.
Okay, you're welcome, world. There you go. Anyway, yeah.
The Punisher's been out for since December of last year. And I'm just now finally getting around to watching it.
I still have to go watch Iron Fist and the Defenders. And yeah, so I'm fairly behind.
Yeah.
I blame it on the Typhoon Jebi.
I would say probably you definitely be fine with the Defenders. I actually enjoy the Defenders. I couldn't get through Iron Fist.
I've heard that many times. One of the reasons I've avoided it has simply been the incredible bad press around it, where it just felt like I was bummed out before it even began. So anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, it's anyway, so far I've only just a couple episodes. Miami and I have both been watching it. Punisher take on it is that it's pretty violent. Yeah, it's certainly by far the most violent thing that they've done in the Marvel Netflix universe. I mean, it's pretty visceral at points. It is the Punisher. He's got a big skull on his chest. And it's one of those things where I really like what Jon Bernthal has done with the character. He's the only person who's actually portrayed Frank Castle in a way that's really interesting. Like, you want to see him play this character. He does a great job of it.
Not cheesy and two-dimensional kind of cardboard cut out of a guy.
Or just
not the Stallone version.
Stallone version of the Punisher would be interesting, but maybe not in a good way, unless they did they intentionally did like a real crazy parody of it, kind of like a Demolition Man meets.
Well, I kind of mentioned Judge Dredd and how badly that went.
Yeah, that was not good. Thank goodness for Carl Urban Hopefully, oh God, yes. if there's any justice in the world, just a tiny bit, he'll get to reprise that character one more time because he did such a great job.
They're saying justice movie, in the world, Justice League wouldn't suck so bad.
Oh.
But I'm bummed. Sorry.
It's just Carl Urban and more science fiction movies.
Mm-hmm.
Probably a good thing. But getting off the topic there, Stalin is the Punisher. That would be interesting. John Bernthal does a great job as Frank Castle. He plays as Frank Castle, not as the Punisher playing Frank Castle, which is the smart thing to do. I don't think I'm going to. I'm hoping they maybe. I'm only three episodes into it, and it's interesting, but I'm hoping that they don't. I hope they don't do a season two, and not because I don't like what I'm seeing. I just think there's maybe not a whole lot of runway left in what you can do with a character like that. But the cool thing is that they are playing it up like it's a bit of part of it's a bit of kind of like a Tom Clancy esque sort of political thriller. There's Watergate type stuff kind of wrapped up into it. And then on top of that, the one thing that really kind of grounds it into a level of reality, it's away from this big gun toting guy is going to kill Death Wish, going to kill all the bad guys. And, the law won't let him, touch. Is that they do touch on a lot of topics of PTSD and show a lot of these guys, not just Frank Castle, but a lot of other guys who are former soldiers, Marines, Army, who are dealing with, we've been through warfare, we come back and we can't adjust because the world for us just isn't it isn't the same anymore. It doesn't make sense to us anymore. We've been through an experience that practically no one else can relate to except for someone else who's been through that same experience. And I appreciated that they went into that bit of it, and they do so very early on. And so far it's been kind of a constant thing where, he and not just the Punisher, but a lot of people have brought a bunch of stuff back from warfare and are having trouble coping with it. And, there you go.
That's cool. I mean, it's not just good storytelling. It kind of also falls in along the, I think it follows the modern ideal of having better representation in storytelling of people even the Punisher himself, obviously, he's a damaged man and therefore that's his whole drive, but explaining how not just, it's his motivation, he's going to beat a bunch of people up, but even the day-to-day that the person has to live with as a result and, their own inner torment and, how can make good people bad kind of thing. I think it's cool that they're addressing that. But anyway, I definitely have some catching up to do. I was looking forward to The Punisher. And I guess I just missed it in the wash, as it were. So I'll have to go look at it as well. And maybe we can talk about it again after I see some more stuff in the Netflix MCU. Mm-hmm. wait, that'd be the MNU? It doesn't matter. Okay. And then, speaking of Iron Fist, we have Iron Fist season 2. Does it look more hopeful than season 1? I looked at the trailer and it was a guy with a glowing fist going around punching a bunch of crap. And I was like, okay, still doesn't tell me anything. What's your take?
I'm definitely going to pony up for this one. At least Miami really liked Iron Fist, the series, but she said the reason I like this so much is because it was kind of like a comedy.
Okay, so she says if you pretend it's a satire, then all of a sudden it gets way better.
I guess her take on it was that she found it entertaining because every time some calamity was basically befalling these people, what would they do? They would just sit there and stare at each other intensely and perform Tai Chi. And she just thought that was just the funniest thing ever. And I have to agree.
So basically, it's like, hold on. Let me get my calisthenics mat. Okay, here we go. Ready? Let's fight.
Okay, we're going to yoga this out, folks.
I would love to see. And not to insult yoga people, because I know that if you're seriously into yoga, apparently you can do some really amazing stuff. But I mean, Yeah, when you see it as a peaceful way of relaxing. Yeah.
But yeah, the takeaways from the trailer, and it's funny because like two nights ago we were like, our ritual is like, we'll just like hang out before we go to bed and like, all right, let's watch something, you know, something that takes like 45 minutes or an hour at most. And we're flipping through Netflix and it's like, oh, what the hell? Like, the new Iron Fist series is just dropped apparently. And so we were like, literally, Iron Fist or Punisher? Iron Fist or Punisher? Iron Fist 2 or Punisher? John Kent Hoyt. Okay, looks like it's going to be Punisher. And so that's how we ended up watching the Punisher and not Iron Fist 2. But the takeaways are, one, it looks like, for one, Danny Rand finally puts the big yellow do-rag on, the sort of the hallmark of Iron Fist's classic costume.
Yellow do-rag. Yeah. So, yeah, he's going to meet up with Daredevil and he's going to be like, are you totally trying to take my thing?
It's like,
he'd be insulted if he could see, but
it's like, look, Danny, I may be blind, but I can tell that you totally are standing. You're totally jacking my style here. That would be great if they do that. But apparently he's got there's another refugee from Kunlun that he has to compete with. And he's trying to develop this relationship with Colleen. And then Misty Knight shows up. Thankfully, because if this
wait, is a there's a person in this show called Misty Knight.
Oh, that's right. You have a.
Is this a porn?
You didn't watch all of Luke Cage, did you? Because she's in Luke Cage.
Oh wait, no, I have seen Luke Cage. I did watch it all the way through. I loved it. That was great. Yeah, I just forgot the name because that's kind of my thing.
Okay, yeah, she's the cop.
Oh, okay. When you say Misty Knight, as in that. Context is fine. I'm sorry. When you start talking about a guy called Iron Fist and then some woman shows up called Misty Knight, it without context, all of a sudden it's like, I'm sorry, what?
Well, these are all characters from like Marvel's like sort of like 70s exploitation era.
Never said it out loud before, I guess. And all of a sudden it's like, oh.
But she's back in, and she was also in The Defenders, which since you haven't seen it, I'm not going to go any further into her role in The Defenders other than the fact that
are you afraid you're going to spoil it for me? Have you ever been on this show before?
Well, I have been on the show, but hey, I'm going to leave that one for you to find out.
Okay, cool. Fair enough.
She and Colleen Wing end up like kind of coming, you know, basically buddies. And then while these guys are off getting the crap beat out of them and have to go to like, you know, have Claire patch them up, I guess it's up to us to go kick some ass. And it seems that they're kind of setting that up in Iron Fist 2, which I'm like, okay, I will definitely watch that. If this gets kind of like a bit dull, then I at least can count on that Misty Knight and Colleen Wing are probably going to have to go chop up some ninjas or whatever. Because I'm guessing that Jerry Hogarth is not going to be prominently in this one, which like, you know, Carrie Ann Moss was like the one saving grace I thought of the first Iron Fist series. It's like, oh, thank God she's here.
Oh, she's in that one as well. Okay. Yeah. I have to say Carrie Ann Moss's role in Jessica Jones and Daredevil has been, she wasn't Daredevil. I'm not misspeaking myself when I say Daredevil, am I?
I think she's in briefly.
I think that's when she gets introduced.
Yeah, she's very briefly in there, here and there, and then
because then she comes back as strong in season two of Jessica Jones, and because that's when I was like going, wait, what happened in the middle, in between, where suddenly she's diagnosed with was it ALS, and and her whole character arc there is just like a whole thing unto itself. But anyway, yeah, she's brought a lot to it. By the way, Carrie Ann Moss was also in Humans briefly for one season. Doing the rounds. Anyway, you know, before things went to crap in the last episode.
Well, I'm glad that the fact that she's kind of kept her foot in the whole sci-fi door. Going all the way back to, you know, her portrayal as Trinity in the Matrix series.
Oh, so hot. So hot right now. Anyway, the Marvel on Netflix continues to hit it out of the park, and I hope that catching up on these that I will not be disappointed. So I'm looking forward to it, and thank you for reminding me that I've missed a couple, and then I got some stuff to watch. It seems like we cover a lot of Netflix Marvel stuff on this show. I guess it's just kind of comes with the territory.
We're totally not being paid by Netflix Marvel. By the way, Netflix Marvel, if you'd like to pay us,
we are totally, we will talk about you nonstop. But yeah, we love you. Moving on. I apologize. I was totally planning on being honest and doing my homework, but there was this little typhoon kind of hung me up, so I did not watch Phase 4 yet, but I did start looking it up this morning, and I got to watch the trailer, and I did spoil the ending, because that's kind of how I roll. But I mean, you'd kind of given me a hint. I just wanted to see, you gave me a hint in the last episode. I wanted to really see what, because again, it popped up on the YouTube, and I was like, that was my excuse. So anyway, I wanted to see what you meant when they said, this is like how things are going to go, and this is going to be the future, and they're inviting us into this future. And man, that is so 70s. The entire thing is so painfully 70s. And I'm not, that's not a reason to decry the movie, but there's a lot of, it's what I want to say, there's a lot of 70s sci-fi tropes in terms of camera work specifically. Like, that not even are specific to science fiction, but a lot of, I know how to double expose film. This is an owl. This is human eyes. These are human eyes on top of an owl. And it's all very mystical. I will say the fact that it's not a doomsday movie, but a lot more of an, I guess you want to say, informed by the Age of Aquarius crowd. So, like, aliens are coming to take over the world, but actually it's a good thing, and it's us moving forward, was quite interesting. You know, it wasn't, a lot of the movies at that time were, well, I guess, you know, Close Encounters of the Third Kind wasn't negative, but there was there were plenty of things like the Andromeda Strain where, like, wait, was the Andromeda Strain the one, or am I thinking of where they had, like, the alien virus?
That was the Andromeda Strain, where they had the virus that was causing the people's blood to basically turn to like stone.
Yeah, that's right. Or polymer, I think. But yeah, it was bad. So anyway, there are a lot of like the Day of the Earth Stood Still kind of warning movies and stuff like that. And this is one where it's like going, nope. We're basically turning, the entire Earth is turning into a self-aware Gaia, and it's all good. But I'm definitely going to go watch it. It's, and so that I can maybe poke more fun at it, and also, you know, say that I've seen it. There was also I'm curious to see when I watch this movie. There seems to be a little bit of what's that movie? Is it Dark Star? The Alan Dean Foster book that got turned into a movie, or is it the other way around?
So the one that was. Is that the one that starred Dan O'Bannon? And,
yes, we've actually talked about it before on this show. Actually, same year. Holy crap! But there was not in story, but maybe in the way the story was told and some of the themes, a little bit of a Dark Star vibe in it for me. And the fact that they both came out in the same year, maybe that's not surprising. Wow, I feel kind of smart right now.
Well, I mean, you could say that there might have been something in the water. Back in the, was it 1974 or 75 when that came
something
out?
Something in the water pipe.
Yeah.
in any case. But maybe a little bit more in the LSD arena. But yeah, I will definitely catch up on that. Yeah. I will definitely catch up on that and watch it. Okay. Science fiction wise, I think we're good. It covers our list. You got anything else to add?
Not really. I think pretty much, we've talked enough about superhero stuff at this point. And
Actually, I guess it's kind of our theme of the day.
Yeah, I guess if you defer those who are listening, here we go. I'll throw in like one weird science fiction movie wreck at the very end of this, since we're talking about Phase 4. If you did watch Phase 4, if you have watched Phase 4, seen it before, and you liked it, if you were like, okay, it's clearly not the best movie ever made, but intriguing from a visual standpoint.
It's better than Manos Hands of Fate. Let's be frank.
Certainly, this is true. Both of which actually were lampooned on Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Boom.
there you go. But there is a movie that came out about 10 years ago, a little less, I think about 8 or 9 years ago, that visually you could say was like heavily influenced. In fact, actually the director even said that, like, yeah, Phase 4 was a major influence on my visual style, and particularly in this film. And that was a film called Beyond the Black Rainbow.
Wow.
Which,
it's an ambitious
name. It's a real cult movie, and the soundtrack is very like, if you know me personally and you hear the soundtrack, you're like, yeah, this is definitely something Gary would be heavily into. because it is. And if you're into weird 70s science fiction that's kind of like that, then you should go and get yourself a copy of Beyond the Black Rainbow and watch it. Don't think too hard about trying to explain what, or try and figure out what's going on. Just sit back and enjoy it visually. And there you go.
Right.
Gary's weird science fiction rec for the episode.
Before we completely leave the topic behind about Phase 4, I do want to mention, I'll put a link in the show notes to Bad Astronomy talking about what planetary alignments actually mean in astronomical terms. And that was definitely, again, speaking of the Age of Aquarius vibe, I think that's one of the reasons why that came to mind. Planetary alignments are not that big a deal on a cosmic scale. You can hear people like Neil deGrasse Tyson talk about it, and of course the infamous Bad Astronomy website. They're cool, but it's always really funny. Let me put it this way. Just like eclipses, and of course, if you're listening to the show, you probably already know all this. Planetary alignments are a very local and therefore kind of self-involved kind of a thing. In other words, for example, if you're watching an eclipse right now and you're like, oh my goodness, that's going to be the end of the world. For the majority of the planet, the eclipse isn't actually happening right now. So yeah, just saying. It's a whole thing. So that's my nerd glasses for the week. Sorry about that. But yeah, oh my goodness, the planets have come into alignment, and now the aliens have come to take over the world. Like, really, the aliens are waiting for that? You've got to be kidding me.
Illuminati confirmed.
Yeah. Oh, actually, you know what? We should mention, I think we kind of mentioned this towards the beginning of the episode, too. Or maybe it was before we started recording. When it comes to the idea of aliens coming to take over any given planet, people should also keep in mind that it's a fun story, but the practicality of an alien species actually doing that, unless they had some serious, you know, hard on for coming in and just harassing another alien species, there isn't a lot in it for them. If they have the ability to cross interstellar distances, going into a gravity well to harvest resources is kind of a stupid thing to do, because there's so much out there, even just in the Oort cloud of our own solar system, that bothering to go to all that effort and waste all that energy is kind of stupid. So, yeah.
Which the moral of the story is, if an alien invasion does show up on our shores here on our little blue marble in this part of the Milky Way galaxy, it's for one reason and one reason only, and that's because the aliens have decided to challenge us in football.
Ooh. Oh, thank you. You reminded me. Yes. So I'm still in the middle of reading it. I've read the first page. I did not realize. And the way this came across last week, I kind of got, I guess, a little muddled. But yeah, I'm reading Gary's excellent recommendation of trying to see the title on the tab here. It's basically, was it Football 17776?
It's hard to read those numbers because it's kind of like a discombobulating like series of digits when you're trying to process that. Like, yeah, that actually theoretically will be a year at some point. 177076.
Yes.
Or what football will be, what the future of football will be like. And by John Boyce from SB Nation, which...
There you go.
Yeah, football season just started. However you feel about the sport, go read it. It's actually a lot of it's a mostly science fiction, with the fact that football just happens to be sort of like, yeah, that's a thing in this universe.
We're topical. We're on the ball here. And I gotta say, yeah, it's even just page one is a trip. If you're it's also a very nice, I want to say, old school approach to it brings me back to the 90s in terms of how the page is put together and the way the graphics are done, both in terms of like some of the interactive games at the time, like Myst, and even just stories that you'd be able to download off the internet in the computer lab at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
You know, so it's even just in terms of presentation, it's worth looking at. And again, we'll put the link in the show notes. I'm looking forward to finishing it. Some of the, it's got some very lo-fi graphics, but they're really well-placed and unapologetic. And again, as I always like to say, that's when you just, it lets you buy into it without worrying too much about whether or not the skin on the aliens looks real, kind of thing. So yeah, I'm having fun reading it, and I look forward to finishing up and reporting next week. All right. So we're going to head off to the after show. You're welcome to join us. And this week looks like we'll be talking about non sequiturs in Japanese and why giving people money is bad. Specifically in Japan, by the way. That's a story I have. Thank you for joining us this week on News from Tomorrow. You can always follow us on the interwebs. We're on the Twitters and the Facebooks. And please share us with your friends, where all fine podcasts are sold. Gary, you got any last words?
Nope. We're about to get a couple of massive storms hitting us over here in the States pretty soon. So everyone stay dry, stay safe.
All right. We now return you to your regularly scheduled time stream.
Adios.
本日は当便にご来場いただき誠にありがとうございました。
Anyway, so what is this non sequiturs in Japanese?
This is actually a dinner conversation from earlier in earlier today here in the Spillman household, and I was hoping that this is something maybe you could weigh in on.
I have an opinion on everything.
Exactly. So one of the things that we had a Skype session with Miami's parents, and we kind of got to laughing at the situation because. This typically happens whenever, like, all of us are having a conversation, whenever we go back to visit them, or whenever we're visiting each other online through Skype or FaceTime, and that, like, the conversation sort of breaks down into not so much like four people having a conversation. It's more like three people talking at one another, and then one dude who's just kind of sitting there and just kind of like, I don't know, I guess so. And then that's basically it.
Which dude would that be? Would that be you, dude, or...?
That would be the dude.
Yeah.
And but the and Maya was talking about that, like, yeah, my family and friends have always been kind of like the way I described it in English is like, it's not so much we're having a conversation, it's more like everyone's sort of like talking at each other simultaneously. It's like, yeah. And I mentioned, like, you know, I think it's more of a Kansai thing than it is like anything else. And she kind of agreed with me, because when I 20 years ago, when I first moved to Japan to study, the host family I studied with were very much from Osaka. I mean, very, very like blue collar, huge Tonchin Tigers fans, like just, and very fast talking, very like, you know, very, very Kansai.
Yeah. By the way, if you want to learn Japanese, Kansai is like literally the worst place to do it. unless you're on speed. Because unless you're able to like live in a like parallel and simultaneous timeline where you can speed things up or slow things down for your brain to catch up, it's just like it's a crash course. Let's just say that
it's if you want to learn Japanese on hard mode, go to Osaka.
That's it. Hard mode. I like it. Survival mode.
It's hard mode.
Yeah,
it's like you open up the main menu to start a new game of Doom, and you just kept pressing the down arrow when it came to difficulty selection screen, and you said, "Let's just go with that one." Yeah, the one that looks really freakishly scary. And then I mentioned to Miami, like, kind of comparing and contrasting, like, you know, some of the similarities were that when I was living with my host family, I remember having a very hard time keeping up with the conversation, and it made things tremendously more difficult than it probably should have been, because here I was, like, I didn't speak Japanese, like, worth a lick, you know, like, I introducing myself and saying, excuse me, can you tell me where the bathroom is, about the further extent of my capabilities of speaking, and then reading, obviously, like, I got hiragana and katakana, but other than that, that was about it. Mm-hmm. So trying to keep conversation with them, especially at dinner time, was just like, oh my God, I would come away with migraine headaches just from my brain just trying to process everything and trying to keep up. And it would be like three separate conversations going on at once. And it would just be like kind of like this conversation relay where they would trade from one point to another point with absolutely no segue, no warning, just complete non sequiturs interrupting other non sequiturs on top of other non sequiturs. So if you're trying to learn a language as your second language or your third or whatever, and you're trying to do this conversationally, this sort of environment is, as you said, less than ideal.
I wouldn't say the word toxic is inappropriate, but brain meltdown comes in mind. The thing is that for people who haven't studied a second language, as you can imagine, it might seem pretty understandable if you think about it, that context is a big part of knowing what's going on. So one of the bigger challenges in mastering a second language is being able to walk into the middle of a conversation and pick up what's going on, versus one of the reasons why it's really good to watch TV in order to help brush up your listening skills is because there's a plot. And if you don't know the plot, you aren't going to know what's going on. So I think that's really appropriate to what you're saying here, in terms of if non sequiturs is kind of a trend in that particular neck of the woods, then it's not going to be the best place to learn the language. I honestly can't say. I guess I have had some experience with that. I think I had the feeling that, but I don't know if it's anecdotal, like personal to just my own particular interactions with people, or if it is a Kansai trend, although I could see it being a Kansai thing. Happened for me was, I'm sorry, what?
I was going to say that was kind of my stance on it. Mm-hmm. Just anecdotal, but both my Amy and I recognize that neither of us have known enough people from, like, say, Tokyo or the Kanto area to be able to do an easy comparison contrast. Say, like, oh, clearly that's like Kansai, like it's sort of a Kansai hallmark of just the local culture and the way they use the language there or not. And so we just kind of like,
I tend to try to have five conversations at the same time. If you're like in a large group, like with friends at a Nomikai drinking party get together. Mm-hmm. I do think that's a thing. And that's just rowdy people having fun, and Kansai people, I do think, do kind of bring that to a new level. Let's be fair, a little bit of hometown pride. They definitely do know how to party. For me, maybe it's a little bit more embarrassing to admit. I think people around me would tend to use non sequiturs because they don't know what the hell I'm talking about. And they're like, anywho, move on. I think especially, you know, again, as a foreigner having moved to Japan and trying to learn the language and the culture, and it is not a stereotype to say that it is a hard culture to integrate into, because people simply don't hold you to any particular standard. You're not a Japanese person. So if you're a Japanese person, they would hold you to a particular standard and you would be expected to get along, integrate, and so on. But as a foreigner, they give you carte blanche to basically do whatever you want, and they just write it off as, well, he's a foreigner, he doesn't know any better. Also, if you're not fluent in the language and you mumble something and they're like going, I don't know what that was, but I don't want to embarrass this guy, so I'm just going to keep talking about whatever. And in my other foreign experiences, having lived with my host family in Germany, where I did become fluent in the language, my host father particularly was awesome with non sequiturs. But again, that's super anecdotal in a totally different culture. But I can draw parallels, but again, my own. I have found that the Kansai culture and the particular culture I lived in Saxony in Germany had a lot of parallels. It has to do with their sense of humor, their way of talking, their boisterousness. I would say if anybody's going to be guilty of it, if you especially consider the Kansai association with comedy in Japanese culture, when you sit there and you know, it's like being from a city like New York in the United States. You say, oh, well, he's from Kansai. And they're like, oh, well, then it's fine. Of course he talks that way or acts that way. So I think it's worth looking into. And Ben, I think you might be onto something, but I can't offer anything more definitive than that without, you know, just blowing smoke out my butt. So sorry.
Okay. No worries.
It's an interesting point. No, but it's something I'm going to look out for now. Machiko and her mom are really the only, family I have here right now. And they're buttoned up a little tighter. So, it would be interesting. Their dynamic is very specific. So, but when it comes to hanging out with people, like the next time I go to a Nomikai, I'm going to pay closer attention, assuming I'm not already three sheets to the wind. Anyway, so the other topic that I had here was something I don't know if you've had experience with, but so I watched one of those infamous videos or lists you might find on the internet about things you need to know about Japan. And I instantly put on my nerd glasses and say, oh, well, we'll just see about that. I'm going to test how accurate this list is. And of course, typically, every situation is different, but you're going to find, at least a couple things wrong, if not the entire list, because, every situation is different and we all know better. But this one did have one, having lived here longer, I feel a little bit more confident, but it had one interestingly egregious mistake, which was the idea that handing money to a cashier in Japan is bad, and that's why they have the little dishes on the counter. What's your hot take on that? Is it bad to hand money, cash, to a Japanese person, Gary?
Man, I totally kind of forgot about those things. Yeah. Oh, man. Culturally, is it bad? I think is it bad? Like, are people going to look at you like you're some kind of uncouth, unrepentant, scumbag? Especially if you're a foreigner in Japan, no, they're just probably going to look at you and go like, oh, probably, okay, you probably have never seen one of these things before, maybe. Or just like, okay, you're handing me my cash. Cause I've made this mistake before when I was living over there, and they just kind of generally, at the worst I probably ever got was just kind of a puzzled look and then just kind of shrug. Okay, whatever. But I never got anyone talking to me about it or yelling me at it or anything beyond that at all. And I think it's just more of and Japanese culture in itself is sort of one of the sort of overriding principles you see throughout all of it, and you'll see it manifest itself in different ways, is sort of a very fine but very well defined line between personal space, personal sort of area or zone, and then everything else. And the whole purpose of the little coin tray is so that you don't have to make personal contact with this person and hand them your filthy money. You simply put the filthy money here, and they can take the filthy money when they are good and ready to take the filthy money. And so obviously it's less to do with hygiene and more to do with I'm not trying to be forward interrupting, your whole orochi or what have you, not by simply making physical contact with you. You may not be wanting to do, hey, my hands might be sweaty, but yeah, never mind that yen is probably filthy. It's been in my pocket all day. But here it is for you for whenever you're ready to put that in the cash register. I'm not trying to impose upon you, take my money. I'm just saying, here's my money. Please take it.
Yeah.
So sort of the more polite version of the fry meme, shut up and take my money. It's more my money is here. You may take it, and when you are ready, thank you very much. And I will take my groceries. You know?
Actually, I will say there are certain places, there are certain izakayas, which are the Japanese version of a pub, that are more pay before you go, pay as you go. I actually had one place, it kind of threw me off the first time it happened, but the guy's he had people who were doing eat and run. Dine and dash. Okay, here's my take on it. And in terms of the dish. Now, I actually had run into this, this particular topic about the dishes and their origin, which is nobody really knows, but they are not that old. They may have been, I want to say they're even within the last century, but they do. I'm actually going to put a link here from the Japan Times because this is the original article that I read that I happened to just find, which is very cool. Anyway, they do have, as you said, Gary, they do serve a really good purpose in Japan. And I think it basically got adopted into Japanese culture because it's very compatible with the Japanese way of thinking. And in this particular case, not just the hygiene and invading personal space, but also it's the personal contact thing. Instead of having people having a cringy moment of like, oh, am I going to touch this person? Are my hands sweaty? Are they, you know, is it going to look weird if I wipe my hands off afterwards? The dish also gives you, whether you can communicate in Japanese or not, a place to put your darn money and a place to get your money back. So, but it isn't taboo to hand the person the money directly. It's just simply, as you said, it's become a custom. It's fairly recent, but there's no deep roots in Japanese society. Now, this has, in terms of public transactions, when you're in a commercial situation, such as a restaurant or the convenience store or the supermarket, perfectly legit. Little side note, 7-Eleven in Japan does not have dishes at all. So there you go. I guess they decided to be way more cosmopolitan and said, you know, screw that. We're not going to waste our money on these silly dishes. So, but there are roots in Japanese culture in terms of private exchanges of money. And this is probably why the dishes were so compatible with the Japanese way of thinking. So in Japanese culture, there are definite rules about exchanging money in personal situations. So you know about the envelopes, right?
Oh, yeah, of course. And there's the different color-coded ones.
That's right. So you got envelopes. And I had to look up the colors myself. But there's envelopes. One red is for celebration or auspicious occasions. Black is for funerals.
Yeah.
So there are certain situations within your personal community of people you know or who have social obligation to where it is absolutely socially appropriate, if not mandatory, to give a certain amount of money to a person, for example, upon the birth of a child or upon their wedding or upon the passing of a important person or loved one. Let's see if I can look. Japan cash envelopes. Colors. Let's see if I can come up with some of the other. There's some other colors I never really looked. They're called Shugibukuro, by the way. Let's see here. I'm curious about which colors they have. Oh, it doesn't really say. That's too bad. I'll have to look it up and get back to people. But okay, so here is, and so it's usually a very soft-spoken affair. Japanese people really don't like to, you know, talking about money is gauche. Although apparently it's like you can ask a person how much money they make and that's okay. I've never really seen that pan out in real life, but I've heard that. In any case, I'll tell you the definitive thing about why it's taboo to give naked money to a person in Japan. And that does have to do with personal relationships. I think it was the first time I tried to pay my dues at the Aikido Dojo. I handed a large bill to the teacher, and then I asked for change. And he turned several colors of purple, and he just turned away in disgust. And I was like, I'm sorry, what just happened just now? And our buddy Mizuwaki explained to me. He says that when you pay your dues, you put it in an envelope, and you always bring the exact change because it shows thoughtfulness. Also, because handing cash to a person, naked cash to a person, is usually dealt with in a business transaction setting. The problem is that when you're handing money to a cashier and you're the customer, well, the customer is God. Of course, you are socially above them. When you hand the money to a revered teacher of the dojo and say, please give me some change, you're putting him at the same level as the cashier at a ramen shop. Can you see where this would be a problem?
Oh yeah, this is one of those things where understanding propriety and station and how that works in Japanese society is kind of like, yeah, I
basically just said, you know, I said, hey, boy, get me my change. This is chopsticks in the rice bowl level of stupid. So.
Yeah.
So yeah, there you go.
It's actually, I'll relate a quick story that involves these little envelopes. It's kind of funny, and it all worked out in the end, and everyone understood, like, kind of like, oh, who made the mistake and why and what after the fact, and everyone had a hearty laugh about it. But so when I was an ALT in Osaka, we had one of our guys at the Board of Education who supervised all of us and the JET program there. He was a real sweetheart of a guy to work with, and he was also, of course, being from Osaka, a massive Hanshin Tigers fan. And then two of our coworkers, who actually lived in the same building that I did, they were big baseball fanatics too. They were A's fans, and they kind of understood having a team that, like, was really cool, had a huge fan base, but also kind of like, yeah, kind of had long droughts between championships. So they really identify with that. And then they wanted to do something nice for him because he had just had a job anniversary or something. I forget what the situation, but they wanted to do something for him. And they said, hey, let's get him tickets to go see the Tigers play. You know, just go buy him tickets because he is another season ticket holder. Let's just get him, you know, tickets for the game after. And it's like, oh, cool. It's really sweet. You know, sweetheart thing to do. So they got him a couple of tickets so he can go with a friend or his wife or whoever. And and they gave it to him. They probably gave him to me the envelope. The problem is they got him the black and white envelope and not the red envelope.
Oh, Jiminy Christmas.
And they didn't know the difference. They just thought, like, oh, well,
it looks
black
cool.
And white. Well, they couldn't find they picked it because it was like, well, black and white. Well, if we put some gold foil on it, you got the Tigers, like, you know, the home colors and whatnot. Makes sense, right? And then, like, then they found out later, it was like, yeah, that was the funeral envelope.
That is so, go, oh my goodness, go, I would be so go, mortified. That's
they
so
go
terrible.
On the sweat mark down, it's rolling down the side of the face there. And then, but of course, they found out, like, after the fact, and like, you know, he was very touched the fact that they actually went thoughtfully bought him baseball tickets.
Right.
And then they all had a hearty laugh over the fact that, like, well, I guess this is what you're saying about, like, what you think the season's going to be like for the Tigers this year.
Yeah, at least it didn't imply that he's going to die. Sorry. Well, actually, yeah. No. Yeah, sorry for your loss. That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, yeah, actually, going briefly back to, I told that anecdote to Machiko, and I introduced it with, I found out about, you know, how to give money to people in Japan was at the dojo. And she goes, oh, really? And I said, yeah, I handed Kinoshita Sensei the money and then asked for change. And she said, oh. So, I mean, her reaction immediately was like, oh. So I felt like whoops. So she actually said something interesting because people should appreciate, as hard as much of a closed society Japan appears to be, a lot of it can be attributed to just Japanese shyness and the lack of social structure for dealing with outsiders, which you will even see within Japan. Just go on any given train and see how rude people are to each other. But they will bend over backwards to try to help you justify your actions, especially as a non-Japanese person, even Japanese people saying, like, you'll see them pass laws and then repeatedly not enforce them because they're like, well, I'm sure that dude's got his thing. There's a reason why he couldn't follow the law just now. So it happens over and over again. Machiko complimented Kinoshita Sensei saying, it's cool that he's that open-minded. And I was like, what do you mean? She goes, he didn't treat you like a foreigner. In other words, he got mad at me just like he would at anybody else. So I was like, oh, interesting backhanded compliment. Cool. So there you go. That's my little insight into what I hope is accurate insight into a little bit of a quirk in Japanese culture that you might not run into, or at least not, again, as you said, not have it explained to you until you show up with the funeral envelope and people are like going, what did you just do? Yeah, another reason, by the way, never wear a black tie with a suit. I did that once at a job interview. So
yeah,
sorry for your loss. It's like, what, you guys think black ties are only for funerals? Okay, that's a thing.
Yeah, it definitely would have been like, well, I'm sorry you just came to the funeral, but let's talk about this job thing, I guess. And like,
oh. Yeah, right. Wow, I'm glad you were able to squeeze your aunt in there. Yeah, that's all I got. How about you?
I think that's it for me.
All right, let's wrap it up there. That's nice. An hour and 30. We did a good job. I think it was pretty tight.
Alrighty.
Awesome. All right, guys. Catch you later.